Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. Oh, my. And it's October 21st. Don't forget, exam 3 is next time in class. And it's going to cover the two chapters in muscle and then the introductory chapter on nervous tissue. So that's chapters 10, 11, and 12. Only three chapters, not a lot of questions at the end of the book for those. So I guess maybe really study your notes as well. And of course, the exam figures, man, if you're not planning to get 100% on the exam figures, maybe I'll see you next semester. I don't know how else to say it, right? I mean, it's just right there for the taking. So make sure you just get 100% on those figures. Okay. To get prepared for the test a little bit, I just want to do, okay, let's see who comes up with the right answer. How about a quiz, flash quiz right now, okay, on the various neuroglia and various neurons. So I want to know what the name is, what the structure is, where it's located, and what the function is. So let's work through some of these things real quick. That's not what I have on the board, so let me see. What do I got right here? All right, so that's not looking too bad. You don't see anything. Okay. Let's punch this button. See what happens. Let me dial in the projector and get that turned on for you. All right, so as we're warming up, does anybody have any questions? Oh, you know, I did get a couple emails about putting the audio lectures online. I know I'm behind on that. And I'll try and do that tonight before 11 p.m. Okay, but I'm in class till 6, so there's no chance that I can do it today. And I didn't have a chance to put them online, so sorry about that. But I'll make sure that I get them online tonight. All right, so here we see a number of different kinds of cells. So what are the two general names for the cell types that we see up on the screen? There is a... We have satellite cells. That's a very specific name, but I'm interested first in the two general classes of cells we see. We see in yellow a neuron, and then in white, neuroglia, or support cell. And maybe this has a little bit different color to it. I don't know. Does that have a different color? I call it white. It's purple. Okay, well, that's not white at all. Okay, so these are support cells too. All right, so... talking about this neuron, remember nervous tissue is made up of neurons and neuroglia, and this particular neuron is what type of neuron? How many processes are coming out of the soma? You see how many processes coming out?
One.
You see one. What's another name for one? Uni, right? So this is a unipolar neuron. Of course, it bifurcates into a central process and a peripheral process, but that's the neuron. What's the function of a unipolar neuron? It is a sensory neuron. And when we say sensory, what does that mean? Wow, you could really talk 1,000 words with one picture. What is a sensory nerve by function? Which way are signals moving? Sensory is from the periphery into the central nervous system. That is sensory. And what's another name for sensory? A more scientific name would be afferent, right? So it's an afferent neuron. All right, what else was I thinking about this one right here? I had another good question for you, but I forgot. All right, so that's the neuron. And the neuroglia, right? Somebody said, well, these are satellite cells right here. Absolutely. And then what are these cells right here? Those are Schwann cells. What's the chemical substance that a Schwann cell synthesizes?
Myelin.
Myelin, yeah, and it wraps that myelin around the axon. And what does it allow this neuron to do?
Speeds it up.
Speeds up the rate of a nerve impulse. Oh, that was my question. All right, so a nerve impulse travels over this neuron, and what can you tell me about the direction? You just told me something about the speed, which is really good. If it's a myelinated axon, it's fast. What do we call it if it's fast? Because it's a myelinated axon, saltatory conduction, right? Saltatory conduction because the nerve impulse actually hops from one node of RON VA to the other. Now, what's the direction?
Up.
Does it spread equally in all directions, or how does it go?
One direction.
One direction. And that direction is? Dendrite to cell body down the axon, right? So that's how it goes. All right, so that's the cell. Oh, one last question about this particular neuron right here. Where is it located? Because you can tell because of the neuroglia. Where do you find these types of neuroglia? Only? Somebody said it over there, but you're shy. That is in the peripheral nervous system, right? Satellite cells, Schwann cells are found only in the peripheral nervous system. All right. Anybody got a question on this one here? No? Okay. Let's go to the next one. Not so interesting, but here's one. What do you see? Neuron or neuroglia? Yeah, neuroglia. What kind of neuroglia? Give me the name. Oligodendrocyte. So that's what I want to hear when I show this slide. Now, where do you find this? Central nervous system. What's the function that it performs? Allows for saltatory conduction. And does that mean something to you when I say saltatory conduction? Fast. Okay, good. All right, so that's something about that cell. What do we got here? Yeah, multipolar neuron. Okay, and what's the function of this kind of guy? Of course, it doesn't have sex, but let's pretend. What's the function? It's motor. That's a motor neuron. It's also what? An interneuron. Interneuron. Where do you find interneurons? Only inside the central nervous system. They're completely within the spinal cord and brain. If it's a motor neuron, the cell body is going to be in the spinal cord, and then the axon leaves the spinal cord and goes out to the periphery someplace. All right, so it's actually in both. But an interneuron is completely within the central nervous system. Okay, what do we got? What are the two kinds of cells? Neuroglia or neuron? What's your choice? Neuroglia. What kind of neuroglia? It's got a name. Astrocyte. What's the function of an astrocyte? It has a number of different functions. It makes a blood-brain barrier. It adjusts electrolyte levels around neurons. And it regulates the action of neurotransmitters at a synapse. And it even secretes trophic factors so that neurons can, okay, interface with each other. All right, and actually that's how your brain grows. That's how you learn stuff, when neurons make new connections with each other. So this astrocyte is responsible for that. Where do you find it?
Yeah.
Central nervous system. Okay. Hey, there's no practicums today, you guys. You got to start studying this stuff. All right, what do we got here?
Microglia.
Where do you find it? Central nervous system. What's the function? Yeah, it's a killer cell, right? It's important for immune response. It protects your brain from infection. All right, what's this? Oligodendrocytes. Where do you see them? Central nervous system. Central nervous system. Yeah, CNS. And what's the function?
Speeds up.
Yeah, saltatory conduction. Right. And then we've got, what do we got right here? Does it look like a neuron? I hope not. So if it's not a neuron, what is it? Process of elimination. It's a neuroglia. What kind of neuroglia? You see it forming a layer. All right, that's an ependymal cell. It lines the ventricles. And it also helps make the choroid plexus, which secretes cerebrospinal fluid into the ventricles. That's its job. And what do we got here? So what's the thinking process? Neuron or neuroglia? Neuron. What kind of neuron? Look, here is a single process coming out of the soma. So this is a
unipolar.
Unipolar, because there's just one process coming out, right? One is uni. Unipolar neuron. And what's the function of this unipolar? Sensory. It's a sensory. What's another name for sensory?
Afferent.
Okay. Let's see what's next. Neuron or neuroglia? That's your thinking process. It's a neuron. What kind of neuron? two processes coming out of the cell body, right? So we call that bipolar. And the function of a bipolar is special senses, like vision, olfaction. Okay. All right. So this slide right here, tell me the name of the neuron. The type?
The multipolar.
Multipolar. And these little things, are these artifacts or are they real? They're real. What are they?
Schwann cells.
Schwann cells. So where is this axon located? That's a peripheral nervous system because you see these Schwann cells right here. And you could tell me a lot of other things about this particular picture if I asked. Ah, what are these cells right here?
Satellite
cells. And they're found? Peripheral nervous system, right? Satellite cells, peripheral nervous system. And what's that string of cells there? Schwann cells. Where? Peripheral nervous system. All right, so I think we went over all of the cells. So are you ready? Should I have you put your books away? No, let's just take it for fun. Okay. All right, so you got to say it before I say it. Ready? What's the neuron? What's the neuron?
Unipolar,
right? Here's a unipolar neuron, and you see Schwann cells and satellite cells. Easy for you to say. Okay. And where would you find that? Peripheral nervous system, right? And that's a sense afferent neuron. Okay, watch the screen.
Oligodendrocyte.
Where? Central nervous system. Multipolar neuron. What's the function? Motor. Yeah, you could say it's a motor neuron. That's great. Or you could say interneuron. Astrocyte. Where? Central nervous system. It adjusts what? Electrolyte levels around the neurons. Are electrolyte levels important? Yeah. Hey, give me a couple names of electrolytes that you know of. Sodium.
Potassium.
There's even calcium that's important for synaptic transmission. All right, where do you have to have sodium at high concentration in a resting cell? Outside or inside? Sodium is outside. What's inside?
Potassium.
That's right, potassium. See, it's really helpful to say this out loud. You're actually, what, making new connections in your brain. I can see that happening. Your heads are squishing around like crazy. Okay, next one. Microglia cell. What's the function? Immune response. Yeah, fight infection, immune response, same thing. Where? CNS. Oligodendrocytes. CNS. Ependymal cell. Ependymal cell. They line the ventricles, make cerebrospinal fluid in the central nervous system. Okay, let's go back and look. One single process coming out. Unipolar. Unipolar neuron. Okay, unipolar. All right, you'll get it sooner or later, but if you don't get it by the end of lecture, you got to look at it over the weekend. Otherwise, you'll be unhappy with yourself on Monday. Okay, what do we got here? Bipolar, right? Because there's two processes coming out. What kind of neuron?
Multipolar.
Satellite cells, peripheral nervous system. Schwann cells, peripheral nervous system. Unipolar neuron, sensory, afferent neuron. Oligodendrocyte, CNS.
Multipolar.
Astrocyte. All right, so now let's just say the name of the cell and not get so involved with saying the function. So that means since we don't have to say so much, I can go a little faster. Okay, so ready? I don't know if you guys in the front row can actually see that, but here we go. Okay, you guys are hot. You're on the track. It kind of looks like a macrophage, but in the nervous system, it's called what? Microglia. Or you could say microglial cell, right? Microglia. But it's acting like a macrophage in other parts of your body, namely in that it fights infection. Okay. Oligodendrocyte. I know these are all good tongue twisters. They're eye twisters, too. Ready? Ependymal cell. Ependymal, CNS. Unipolar.
Bipolar. Multipolar. Satellite cells. Schwann cells. Unipolar. And you see satellite and Schwann cells all around it? Oligodendrocyte. Multipolar. Astrocyte. Microglia. Oligodendrocyte. Ependymal cell. All right, so that's not bad. At the end of lecture, if we got time, we'll go back and do that again, right? So that's the process of anatomy, is just recapitulating and reworking things that you're a little bit more familiar with all the time. All right, so when you say the name of the cell, what else should flash in your mind? Like if I say oligodendrocyte, you should think?
CNS.
Yeah, the location, CNS, PNS. You should also think neuron or neuroglia. Right, so there's different ways to think about it, right? And so link those concepts together. All right, so let's move on to, well, one of the more interesting chapters probably in the whole book, and this is the central nervous system. And I had some slides open here. Let's look at this one first. All right, so central nervous system, what the heck makes up the central nervous system? From the previous chapter, the brain and the spinal cord. We're first going to look at the brain and then look at the spinal cord. So let's look at some of the five main regions of the brain. So the brain is everything superior to the spinal cord. Where does the spinal cord change and actually become brain? There is a nice line of demarcation. There's a sharp change. The nerves are the same, all right, but there is a place in the body where we can definitely say right here is the brain and then right below it is the spinal cord. What is that? There is a hole in the cranium. And what do you call a hole in a bone? It's a foramen, so then you got to tell me the name of this foramen. Foramen magnum, right, foramen magnum. So, everything below the foramen magnum is spinal cord. Everything superior to it is the brain. And so here is the whole brain right here. Let's talk about this first section right here that's closest to the spinal cord. Since the whole brain is sitting on top of this part of the brain, we call this the brain stem. Everything else flows from this area right here. The most inferior part is called the medulla oblongata. All right? And then right superior to that is the pons, and then superior to that is the midbrain. So we're going to talk about some functions of these things right here. All right, the next part is the diencephalon, which is made of the thalamus and hypothalamus. And then superior to that, which is the largest part of the brain, is the cerebrum. And you have a right and a left. Those are the right and left cerebral hemispheres. You can only see one on this particular view right here. And then the last major part of the brain is the cerebellum. So let's see, we got cerebellum, we got the cerebrum, we got the diencephalon, and brain stem. Those are the major regions of the brain. All right, so let's go look at this picture right here. So here is a nice sagittal section of the brain. Here is spinal cord. What's just superior to the spinal cord? Okay. The general area is called the brain stem. The specific area, this first bump right here, is called the medulla oblongata. All right. And this is, since it's the lowest part of the brain, most caudal part of the brain, this is the oldest part, even in an evolutionary sense. It controls a number of automatic functions that all animals that have a heart and have to breathe, that means they have lungs, they have to have this part of the brain. Even though they can't do mathematics or take an anatomy test or whatever, they still have to be able to control their heart and breathing. And so there are the respiratory control centers here, the cardiac control centers in the medulla, and other centers that control autonomic function. All right, like swallowing, vomiting, coughing, sneezing. These all occur in the medulla. And also something that adjusts your blood pressure all the time. And it has to do with regulating the diameter of blood vessels in your body. So
So you might wonder, well, what does that have to do with blood pressure? Think of a balloon that's between your hands. Grab a balloon and squeeze down on that balloon. And then think about the pressure inside the balloon. Is the pressure not changing, or is the pressure going up, or is the pressure going down when you squeeze a balloon? It's going up. That's right. If you squeeze hard enough, the pressure will be so great that the balloon, of course, is going to pop. So that's one way that you can regulate blood pressure in your body is by changing the volume of your circulatory system. Vessels will vasoconstrict. Your blood pressure is going to go up. If your blood vessels vasodilate, your blood pressure is going to go down. All right? And blood pressure is necessary to move blood around in your body. And if you don't have any blood pressure, then blood is not going to move. And that's really too bad when that happens. Okay. All right, so that's the medulla. The pons is a relay station for information. So here is the pons, right here. There are signals from the cortex and from the spinal cord that need to get into the cerebellum, and the way they get in is via the pons. So there are tracts that are lateral, which we can't really see, that wrap around from the pons and go into the cerebellum, right? The other thing that the pons does is that it works with the medulla oblongata to control heart rate and blood pressure and breathing. So the medulla and the pons actually work together for many of these things. All right, so here we got the pons. The next thing that we want to talk about is the midbrain. All right, the midbrain is on top of the pons. So right here is the midbrain. There are a number of structures. Oh, there's something I forgot. Okay, that bridge, that major bridge between the pons and the cerebellum, right, it's loaded with axons carrying information, but I tend to think of it as a bridge, and it's given a special name in neuroanatomy, and it's kind of a strange name. I'm not sure I have it in the notes, but you have it in your lab manual. It's called a peduncle. Peduncle. Go ahead, say it out loud, because it's such a weird word, peduncle. All right, so that's a bridge between major parts of the brain. And since these peduncles are carrying signals into the cerebellum, we call that the cerebellar peduncle. And there are actually a number of them, a number of cerebellar peduncles, because here's the cerebellum. All right, so there are signals that have to move from the brain stem, which then the midbrain is part of the brain stem, up into the cerebrum right here. So there is another major bridge between the brain stem and the cerebrum. What do we call a bridge between major parts of the brain? That was that weird word you just said out loud. A peduncle, all right? Okay, but this peduncle, where I have the cursor right here, is not a cerebellar peduncle. It's carrying information to and from the cerebrum, so this is the cerebral peduncle, all right? The cerebral peduncle right here on the ventral side of the brain. And then I see a couple bumps back here posteriorly. There are two bumps on the right side, two bumps on the left side. How many bumps is that all together? That's four. All right. And corpora means body, and quadrigemina means what? Four. All right. So these four little bumps right here are the corpora quadrigemina. The two superior ones, or a bump actually, a single bump is called a colliculus. So we got four different colliculi. Colliculi is plural. The two inferior colliculi right here are important for auditory reflexes. Right? So they're involved with hearing. So if you were all to close your eyes, right? Now let's do a quick, real quick experiment. I don't know whose phone that is. Is that my phone? Not my phone. Okay. So let's do a little experiment. Close your eyes. And then, with your eyes closed, you should be able to tell me, when I say something to you, where I am in the room. So the inferior colliculus lets you localize sound. All right, so close your eyes. And then, without opening your eyes, point to me. Wow, everybody got that right. That should be a question on the test. Actually, we could make that a question on the test. I could say, okay, what part of the brain allowed you to do that? The inferior colliculus of the corpora quadrigemina of the midbrain, okay, which is part of the brainstem. Okay, so those are some That's a pretty long description of it. If you were to say inferior colliculus, that would be fantastic. All right, but try to figure out where it participates in the brain. All right, the superior colliculus right here is also important for other kinds of reflex activity, but not for hearing. It's for vision. The superior colliculus allows you to fixate your gaze on an object. That's one thing, so that you can pay attention to it. But it can also track that object, right? It forces your eyes to track the object as it's flowing through or moving through space. So, I don't know, what's a big sporting event happening right now? Like World Series is coming up, right? Baseball, right? And so these guys are really, really practiced with their superior colliculus because if somebody throws a ball, it just doesn't go in a straight line, right? It kind of moves around, it curves, things like that. And it's the superior colliculus, right, that can actually fixate on that object, track where it's going, and then predict where it's going to be at a certain time later on. Right, so that they can go catch a fly ball or something. So the superior colliculus just allows you to track objects in motion, and that's really important because, right, if you see a bus moving, what do you want to know about this bus? Is it moving at you? Is it moving away from you? How fast is it moving toward you? And if it is moving toward you fast, what are you going to do? You're going to get out of the way, right? So the superior colliculus is very important because vision is such an important sense in our bodies. All right, that's the superior colliculus right there. So that's really all of the midbrain that we need to know about. The cerebellar peduncle, inferior colliculus, superior colliculus, right? And these four colliculi make the corpora quadrigemina. All right, so I think that takes us to, a functional area in the brain. The one functional area of the brain is called the reticular activating system. Sometimes it's called the reticular formation. And what do I have in my notes? Yeah, reticular formation. All right, let me show you where the reticular formation is. It's a bunch of neurons that interact with each other between the pons and the medulla, and there are reverberating circuits in the reticular formation. What's a reverberating circuit? If it gets stimulated one time, what happens to it? It keeps re-stimulating itself over and over and over again until those neurons get fatigued. So the reticular activating system is important for maintaining a wakeful state in somebody, right? You just need to wake up that circuit, and then it keeps a person awake for a really long time. And that happens in the pons and the medulla. And people can have lesions in the pons and the medulla, and guess what? They have trouble staying awake as a result of that, and that condition is called narcolepsy, right? If somebody has a stroke in this part of the brain, or if there's a metabolic imbalance, they'll have trouble staying awake. Even when they're driving down the 405 freeway, they can just fall asleep, all right? And if a judge ever hears about that, what happens? Well, they lose their license, right? And that's for good reason. That's kind of a sticking point in medicine sometimes because, you know, you really hate to see somebody's license get yanked away, but on the other hand, you're not a really good driver if you're asleep, right? So that's unfortunate when that happens. Treatment sometimes is helpful. Other times, we just don't know exactly what's happening there. Okay. All right, so that's the reticular activating system. All right, so the next part of the brain is the diencephalon, made out of the thalamus and hypothalamus. So, where do we see these things? All right, so here is midbrain. We're past the midbrain. Now we're up into the diencephalon. This bulge right here is the thalamus. And the thalamus has a bunch of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Sensory information coming up from the periphery through the spinal cord, arising through the spinal cord and in the thalamus. The thalamus is a relay center to pass that information on to the appropriate locations within the cerebral cortex for your appreciation of that sensory information. So the thalamus is a relay center. And when we say relay, what does that mean? What does a relay mean? Yeah, it passes information on to something else, right? So like if I'm talking very softly, or if I were to write a note and I wanted all of you to know about the information on that note, I'd first give it to you, and then you would relay it to somebody else and just pass it around the room. Okay, so the thalamus is an important relay center. It's sort of like the pons. The pons is a relay center for signals going into the cerebellum. The thalamus is an important relay center for signals going to the cerebral cortex. And we're going to talk about some of the functions of the different areas of the cerebral cortex in just a little bit. All right, the other part of the diencephalon is the hypothalamus. You got the thalamus and the hypothalamus. What can you tell me about that term hypo? Like hypodermis is where? Below the dermis, right? So the hypothalamus is going to be inferior to the thalamus, and this is it right here. So here is the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus controls a number of important things. It controls the pituitary gland, but it also is important because it can measure water content in your body and salt content. It lets you know when you're thirsty, right? It provides a sensation of thirst. It can also adjust some hormones in your body to help you maintain water balance. If you're low on calories, it will give you the sensation of hunger so that you'll replace those calories that you're burning up. And it's also where your thermostat is located, because you have a particular body temperature, which is, what's your body temperature? 98.6, something like that. And that thermostat is in the hypothalamus, so when you're sick, like with the flu, your body temperature goes up because the thermostat in the hypothalamus gets reset at a higher temperature to help you fight that infection. All right, and even more importantly, the hypothalamus controls the pituitary gland. It can send hormones. Let's take a look at it. It can release hormones that go from the hypothalamus into the pituitary. All right, look at the fancy name your book gives it. Hypophysis. That's how you would say the fancy name for pituitary. Hypophysis. Cerebri is the official name, but we just call that the pituitary gland. And here is the connection between the hypothalamus and the pituitary. See this little stalk right there? And sometimes we call it the stalk. Sometimes we call that the infundibulum. And that's part neuronal tissue, part glandular tissue. And what did we call a bridge between different parts of the brain? An important bridge.
Peduncle.
A peduncle, like between the pons and the cerebellum. Cerebellar peduncle. Between the brainstem and the cerebrum. That's the cerebral peduncle. All right, and then there is another connection between the hypothalamus and pituitary. No one ever calls it a peduncle, but all right, maybe you realize that you probably could call it a peduncle if you wanted to. And so, but it's what? Tiny peduncle. So I call it a peduncolito. All right, because it's just a tiny, tiny connection between the pituitary and the hypothalamus. Yes, I'll deny it if you ever say I told you that. Oh, the cerebral peduncle, part of the midbrain, it's right here. All right, so let me describe this area just a little bit more. All right, we got the corpora quadrigemina, which is dorsal. Dorsal means where? Posterior, right, in the back. Anteriorly, we have the cerebral peduncle right here, but notice we have something between them which looks kind of blue. There is cerebral spinal fluid in this little canal right here. So that's what separates the midbrain into the corpora quadrigemina versus the cerebral peduncle. Okay, so that's a nice line of demarcation between them. Okay. All right, let's see what's next. Ah, the cerebrum. Okay. Cerebrum is the largest part of the brain that we see right here. And notice that when you look at the cerebrum, does it look smooth and flat? Or how does the surface look? It's all folded up. It's got all those crinkles on it, right? Because what gives a brain or the cerebrum intelligence or processing power are the numbers of neurons and the interconnections that they make, right? And that's just the result of the surface area of the brain. So if you have a big surface area, okay, how can you take something with a big surface area? Like what's the surface area of a piece of paper? How would you measure that? I won't do it with yours. You'd have to multiply 8.5 inches by 11 inches, That would be the surface area. I should know what that number is, but somebody calculate it and tell me what it is. All right, that would be the intelligence of that piece of paper, because you could load that piece of paper with neurons. Now, how would you take that big piece of paper and fit it inside your head? What would you have to do to it? You'd have to crinkle it up, right? And if you crinkle it up, you could probably put 20 or 30 or 40 of those pieces of paper in your brain, all right? And that would define the intelligence of that organism. All right, so these folds are what we call convolutions. So the surface of the cerebral cortex is convoluted. What does it mean to be convoluted? It means a lot of twists and turns, a lot of crinkles, a lot of folds. All right, so there are some streets that are straight. There are some streets that are convoluted. They have a lot of twists and turns. There are some discussions that you might listen to that are straightforward, and you understand what somebody's talking about, okay? And then there are some exposés that are very convoluted. What does that mean? You can't follow what a person is saying because they talk about one thing and they talk about another. You don't know what the relationship is, right? A lot of twists and turns. What would be a good example of something that you've read or tried to pay attention to that was highly convoluted? Usually related to politics. Right? If you can understand political speech, that's wonderful, like a California proposition or something, right? I find these very difficult to understand. They're convoluted. All right. So a convolution has got a high part. That's what we call a gyrus. And it's got a depression. That's what I call, or well, that's what is called a sulcus, right? A gyrus and a sulcus. And what happens after a sulcus? What comes after a sulcus? Another gyrus. And what comes after a gyrus? Another sulcus. And then you got another gyrus, right? So the surface of the brain is folded up so that we can put more and more neurons in the cerebral cortex. Okay. The other thing about the cerebrum is that it has a number of important lobes. And those lobes are named after the bones that make up the cranium. So you have a lobe that's very anterior. And what bone is right there? Frontal bone, so guess what we call the name of this lobe right here? Frontal lobe. All right, and then right in this region here, we have the parietal bone. That's the parietal lobe, and then way down over here is the occipital lobe. What we can't see on this particular diagram is the lobe of the brain that's by your ear. Okay, and that's the temporal bone, that's the temporal lobe. So, let me see if I can find maybe a little bit different picture of the brain. This is probably pretty good right here. Ooh, this is a real brain. So here is frontal lobe. Here is parietal lobe. Here is occipital. And then here is temporal lobe. Okay. So we can see a big depression between the temporal lobe. Let's see where we can see it on this slide. Yeah. Here is a large depression between the temporal lobe and the frontal and parietal lobe. That's what we call the lateral sulcus. Okay, lateral sulcus. Here is another important sulcus right here. Right, it's going to separate the frontal lobe, which is all of this, with the parietal lobe right here. And it's central in the brain. It's mid-position in the brain, so we call that the central sulcus. So we got a lateral sulcus and a central sulcus. And then there's a big depression between the cerebellum and the occipital lobe. And this is a very, very deep separation between these major parts of the brain. They're not connected to each other. So a very deep separation is not what we call a sulcus. We call it a fissure. Right? So this kind of is on the transverse plane. So that's the transverse fissure separating cerebellum from occipital lobe. Right? There is also another fissure in the brain, because the cerebrum, all right, so here's the cerebrum, for instance, here's a frontal lobe, this depression right here separates the right hemisphere from the left hemisphere. This is the longitudinal fissure, all right, so you got a couple fissures to know about, a couple sulci, but of course, all of these gyri, which is plural for gyrus, and all of these sulci have names, and who wants to learn more names of these gyri and sulci? That, Okay? Okay, a couple more. Just a couple more. Two more. All right, so here we said was the central sulcus separating a frontal lobe from parietal lobe. And this gyrus is very important for us in this class. All right? It's anterior to the central sulcus, so we call this the precentral. Is it a gyrus or a sulcus? It's a gyrus. It's a ridge, right? So here's a ridge. So here's the precentral gyrus. Here is the postcentral gyrus. All right, so you'll always have a good picture or a good model in lab. Some of the models in lab aren't so great in terms of finding the central sulcus, but others, you can see it from across the room, right? So hopefully it will be easy for you to appreciate. Precentral gyrus, postcentral gyrus, and then here is the central sulcus separating the frontal lobe from the parietal lobe. All right. Well, I think we need to talk about some of the functions of these different lobes, the major lobes of the brain. So I think this is probably a pretty good picture. You don't have to know all of these different functions, but for sure know the lobes. Like, here is the central sulcus right here, right? Precentral gyrus, postcentral gyrus. And so this is the frontal lobe. And in particular, this precentral gyrus is very important because this is what has to become activated. It becomes electrically activated. We call that, it develops action potentials. Right? We should review action potential maybe today if we have time. And when action potentials are generated in this part of the body, they leave the central nervous system and they go in particular to skeletal muscle. All right? And what does skeletal muscle do? It contracts. And it contracts under what kind of direction? Your conscious thought. Right? So this is what we call the primary motor cortex. This is the part of the brain where you actually control your body. As a matter of fact, that's the only part of your body that you really can control. So if you have a stroke in this part of the body and some of this tissue dies, what happens? You still have sensation, but you can no longer move that part of the body. Okay? And it might be an arm, might be a leg, might be a swallowing, might be muscles in your throat, or whatever part of your face, okay, so you can't control your mouth on that side of your body or your eyelid, something like that. So this is the primary motor cortex. And what lobe is that in? What lobe is the primary motor cortex in? Frontal lobe. Now, why is that going to be really easy to remember? Because where do you have the motor in your car? It's in the front. Does anybody have a car with a motor right in the middle? Oh, right on. Let's go for a ride later. Okay, that's cool. Okay, but most people have motors in the front of their car. Okay. And if you want to know why that's important, talk to me after class. It's not anything to do with anatomy. All right? It's about being a motor car enthusiast. Okay. VWs have them in the back sometimes. Okay, so I know it can be a little confusing, but just think standard thoughts. Okay. All right, so that's the premotor cortex. The other thing that the frontal lobe does is that allows you to understand what appropriate behavior is depending on the circumstances that you're in. All right, that's not the motor cortex, but we call that the prefrontal cortex over here. All right, so this is where you can manage tasks, you can solve complex problems, you can recall things from memory to try to remember how things worked before. So this is an important area for interacting in your everyday life. Okay, there's another area right here, Broca's area. And this is an important area. See Broca's area right here? Broca's area is important for motor function, particular for speech. All right, so this is the area that generates the spoken language for us, right? So this controls all those muscles that we didn't really pay much attention to, like the hyoglossus and the thyroglossus and the hypoglossus and all those kinds of muscles in your throat. Broca's area right here. All right, what did I forget about the frontal lobe? Okay, basal ganglia. Here is something that we can't see the basal ganglia because they're deep. But maybe I can find another picture of the basal ganglia. This probably is pretty good right here. Okay, so this is in the frontal lobe. See, here is a cross section. What kind of section does this look like to you? Transverse, sagittal, coronal section through the frontal lobe and a little bit through the temporal lobes over here. All right, but this is the frontal lobe in this area. And here I see some areas of gray matter. All right, what do we call gray matter in the central nervous system? And this is a... What do we call gray matter in the central nervous system? What do we call gray matter in the peripheral nervous system? Okay. We have ganglia versus nuclei, or a ganglion versus a nucleus. A ganglion is where? PNS or CNS? Peripheral nervous system. Yeah, peripheral nervous system. A nucleus is in the central nervous system. And how does a nucleus look? White or gray? Okay, a nucleus looks gray because it's nerve cell bodies and dendrites, right? It's not myelinated. So here I see a bunch of white matter, but here I see some dark splotches. These are nuclei because they're in the central nervous system. All right, but before that terminology developed, all right, they were called ganglia. All right, it's a misnomer by today's nomenclature. What should they really be called? Right here, these are the basal... Your book calls them basal ganglia. They should really be called basal nuclei, right? Because they're in the central nervous system. All right, and these nuclei right here are important for developing very coordinated muscle contractions so that your body can move very fluidly, so that you can take steps without looking awkward or tripping. All right, and when these basal nuclei get damaged, you lose that ability to move with a fluid motion. And what happens then is that all the muscles in your body remain contracted, not a maximal contraction, but contracted. So when you try to move, how is motion? It's really hard because you have to fight all of those antagonistic muscles that just aren't relaxing. All right, and that's pretty much the hallmark of Parkinson's disease. When somebody has Parkinson's disease, these basal nuclei aren't functioning. Their gait is very rigid. What is their speech like? Very difficult because they can't get the relaxation of certain muscles, right, in their throat and their tongue, so their speech is slurred. And if you listen to them and watch them, they look like they're intoxicated, actually, because they have lost that equilibrium, right? And, of course, it's really important that when you run into somebody with Parkinson's disease, you don't treat them like a drug seeker or a drug addict or an alcoholic, because there's a lot of stigma attached with those different kinds of processes, right? And it's really embarrassing. Of course, you're going to hurt their feelings and you're going to feel really embarrassed because they have an abnormality in their brain that is usually caused by trauma, okay? And in particular, a good example of that, is there a famous person that you know that suffered a lot of brain trauma that ended up with Parkinson's disease? Like Muhammad Ali. Okay? Because he got his head pounded by these immensely strong, powerful people, right? And that damaged his brain. So, you know what? If you want to become a boxer, maybe you should talk to me before you do that. Okay? All right. Okay, there can be early onset cases of Parkinson's disease. Like there is one example, like Michael J. Fox, right? It usually develops later on in life, not early on in life, but that was kind of an unusual circumstance with him. But we don't have time to talk about that necessarily. But that's what the basal nuclei. Basal nuclei are, what does your book call the basal nuclei? The basal ganglia, right? Just remember that that's a misnomer, and one of these days they'll change it in the next edition of the book. Okay. All right, so that's pretty much it for frontal lobe. Parietal lobe. Let's look at that one. Where's that parietal lobe at? Did we have it over here? Not really. Let's go back. Let's go back to parietal lobe. Where was there a good view of that? Here. This is good. All right, so here's the precentral gyrus. That's in the frontal lobe. The parietal lobe is posterior to the central sulcus, and just like there's an important gyrus in front of the central sulcus, another very important gyrus posterior to it. And this one right here is important for sensation, all right, in particular somatosensory area. So the postcentral gyrus is the primary somatosensory cortex. And when we say somatic, or soma, what's the soma of a neuron? The body, okay? So anytime we use this word soma, it should refer to the body. And way back when people looked at a human being, they thought, well, you know what? You have a body and you have viscera that are deep inside the body. So you have viscera in body cavities, all right? But what really makes up your body? Your skin and muscles and bones, right? So, which is superficial to the deeper organs. So the somatosensory cortex is responsible for sensation on the surface of your body. So pressure, pain, temperature, vibration, okay, that you have on the surface of your body is appreciated in this primary somatosensory cortex of the brain. So if somebody has a stroke in this area right here, but not the frontal lobe, what kind of deficit do they have? Is it a motor deficit or a sensory deficit? It's not going to be motor, right? They can control their body just fine. They will not be able to appreciate sensation on some part of their body determined by what area actually died right here. All right, so they might have an arm that feels like it's anesthetized, or a leg, all right, or maybe a part of their face or something where they have no sensation at all because this part of the brain is damaged. So that's in the parietal lobe. So parietal, as a matter of fact, all the remaining lobes are mostly important in sensation. Okay, but this parietal lobe is important for somatosensory appreciation, which means sense on the surface of your body, your skin primarily. Okay. All right, well, I think I want to talk about the way that the precentral and postcentral gyri are organized. Right? They're organized by what is happening in your body, the somatic part of your person, which is like on the surface of your body. And we can map the area of the surface area on the brain, on the cortex, to a particular location on your body. And when we do that, what develops is a little picture of a person. All right, so here is a picture of a person right here. That little person we call a homunculus. So this shows us the mapping of the surface of the cerebrum to the surface of your body. All right, so here we see the lateral sulcus right here, lateral sulcus. So here is temporal lobe, and then we see red and blue. Red corresponds to the, what does red correspond to? The precentral gyrus. The blue corresponds to the postcentral. The precentral gyrus, we said, is motor, right? That's what's going to control skeletal muscle. All right, so this is just a slice through the precentral gyrus, and you can see that this part over here, down in the longitudinal fissure, controls your foot and your toes. So if this area right here died, maybe as a result of a stroke, what would be the result? Would it be a sensory deficit or a motor deficit? Motor deficit. And what kind of motor deficit? Tongue, finger, eyelids, leg? No, it would be your foot, your toes right here, right? Because this area corresponds to controlling or initiating motion in your toes. All right, and notice that the surface of the brain, okay, the area of the brain on the cortex, corresponds to the amount of control that you have to have in that part of your body. So what part of your body has to have a lot of fine discriminative control? Where do you need a lot of control? How about your back muscles? Do you do a lot with your back? Okay. I mean, do you like write, or do you run around with your back muscles, or what are your back muscles are basically what? Contracting or relaxing? But where do you have a lot of muscles? your hands, right, and around your mouth. So look at the surface of the brain that has, all right, that's controlling your hand. This whole surface right here is controlling your hand. And your face, right, has a lot of muscle control for facial expression. That's a very important form of communication, for swallowing, for breathing, okay, and eating. Requires a lot of brain power, and you see what? A very large surface area for your face. All right, so this is the precentral gyrus. If we go to the postcentral gyrus, the body is laid out pretty much the same way, like here's the face over here, but now if we stimulate this neuron right here, I tell you what, if we stimulate this neuron right here, all right, what's going to happen? What part of your body? Your nose. And what's going to happen? Is your nose going to wiggle or what? Is it motor or sensory?
Sensory.
Sensory, you're going to feel like an itching sensation or some kind of sensation on the surface of your nose. All right? And then if this area here is stimulated, you'd feel something around your belly button, right? Because that's the area responsible for that sensation. So the sensation that you have, the way that you appreciate sensation is because of the area on the cerebral cortex that gets that information. All right? Don't forget, it's the thalamus that takes information from the spinal cord and delivers it to the proper location in the brain so that when somebody, okay, pulls on your ear, you can feel, you can actually sense that somebody's tugging on your ear and not your shoulder or finger or something. All right, so this little guy we call a homunculus, and you can see what gyrus is responsible for either motor control or sensory appreciation. Oh, the other lobes of the brain. Okay, let's finish up with some other lobes of the brain. Where were those at? Okay. Temporal lobe, especially this region right here, this is where you appreciate sounds. That's your primary auditory cortex. Right up over here. You also have a cortex for taste and smell in this region as well. Maybe a little bit deeper for some of those, but those are going to be in the temporal lobe. And the occipital lobe is where the primary visual cortex is located. All right, so this is the part of the brain that you need for vision. All right, so this area becomes activated when you see something. All right, and then when you see something, you might not know exactly what it is, so then this area passes the information on to some deeper areas of the occipital lobe. We call these association areas, so that when you see something, you can tell what it is. Right, if you see a pattern of black and white, you know, who knows what that could mean? So the primary visual cortex passes that information on to association areas, and then it says, oh, well, that's a letter, or that's a type on a piece of paper. And then that information is passed on to even higher centers in the brain, because what do you have to know? Well, what language is it written in? Right, again, it has to do with the patterns of the letters. And information is passed on to higher and higher centers in the brain until you actually can make sense of that information based on your previous experiences. Okay. And this region right here, we call Wernicke's area, and it's sort of like Broca's area that we see up over here. Broca's area is important for motor control for speech. Wernicke's area right here is important for speech, but for understanding speech, right? Not for the spoken language, but for looking at somebody's face, watching somebody's lips move, right? Information comes from the auditory cortex into Wernicke's area, right? And all that information is put together, integrated up so that you can get an impression of what somebody's actually trying to tell you, right? So probably you're all aware that it's not what you say, it's what? It's the information is conveyed by actually how you say that. Okay, so I did a little demonstration in my labs regarding that. Okay, so Wernicke's area is involved with taking all of that information, okay, and making sense out of language. Okay. All right, let's find something regarding the next topic. We're going to talk about white matter versus gray matter once again. Ooh, looks a little complicated. But let's work with this slide a little bit. Okay. So here I see something that's colored very lightly, and I see something colored a little bit dark right here. What are those two areas? What kind of matter? I have gray matter right at the tip of the cursor. What do you find in gray matter? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites? Stuff that's non-myelinated. Things that's not myelinated. And in the white matter, you have myelinated axons, right? So axons carry information. Dendrites and cell bodies receive and share information. All right, so in this area right here, we have myelinated fibers that are going someplace. Now, what do we call myelinated axons in the central nervous system? It's white matter as opposed to peripheral nervous system. If it's in the peripheral nervous system, we call it a nerve. But in the central nervous system, we call it a tract. Okay, so all of this white matter right here are tracts that is carrying information from one part of the brain to the other. And we got three kinds of tracts in the brain. There are tracts that share information between the cerebral hemispheres. So for instance, going back to this slide right here, right, the longitudinal fissure is separating the cerebral hemispheres from each other. And it's really important that the right hemisphere knows what the left hemisphere is doing. Sometimes you have language skills in one hemisphere, and you have mathematical ability in the other hemisphere. Right? So I could tell you the name of a number, like a number 2 and a number 3, and it goes to the right hemisphere. And then I could say, okay, what's the add those two numbers together. Well, where does that information have to go? It's got to go from the right hemisphere to the other hemisphere to get into the mathematical center to add those two numbers together. Right? But it can't get through this longitudinal fissure right here. So how do signals get from one side of the brain to the other? It's through a structure in the brain that is below the longitudinal fissure, and it's called the... Right, it's called the corpus callosum. Here is the corpus callosum. So the longitudinal fissure goes from here to here and it stops. And right here we have tracts that go from right to left. They go from one hemisphere to the other and maybe go back up after the corpus callosum to the appropriate regions in the brain. All right, so the corpus callosum is going to look what kind of color? White or gray? It's going to look white because it's loaded with tracts that are going from left to right. Left to right tracts in the brain are what we call commissural pathways or commissural tracts. Do I have that in the notes? Hope I do. All right, commissural fibers, right, interconnect corresponding gray areas of between the right and left hemispheres. A good example of that would be the corpus callosum. And there's a couple other commissures which I can point out to you in lab. There's an anterior and a posterior commissure. You don't have to know about those. Where are they located for fun? Here's one here, and then there's one over here as well. Okay, that's not so important that you know that. But you should at least know that a commissural tract is taking information how? Right to left, superior to inferior, or between just different lobes or different gyruses in the brain. Commissural is all the way from one side to the other, right and left. Huh?
You said it went only left and right.
Oh, yeah, it's got to go both ways. Either side of the brain has to know what the other side is thinking. Otherwise, it produces really strange effects, right? For instance, if there is a stroke or some tissue in the corpus callosum that's not functioning or maybe it's dead, I could say number 2 and number 3. And that information has to go to the other side of the brain. If I ask you to add those two numbers together, if information can't get into the mathematical center, then a person can't say, what? 5. How did I do? I said 2 and 3? 5? Yeah. Okay. So we just checked out what? Our corpus callosum. Okay. Right, that's a commissural tract. Other kinds of tracts, we have association fibers and projection fibers. Okay, so so these little dots right here represent commissural tracts. They're going from left to right, or right to left, it doesn't matter. Right? And this kind of, what is this outline? This is an outline of the corpus callosum, right? All right, association fibers don't switch from one hemisphere to the other. They stay in the same hemisphere, but they go from one gyrus to the next gyrus. So we call these association tracts or association fibers. The third kind of tract is when information gets passed from an inferior location to a superior location, or the other way around, from superior to inferior, right? We call these projection fibers. They're going up or down in the central nervous system. All right, so let's just review. Commissural go side to side from one hemisphere to the other, right to left or left to right. Projections stay in the same side of the brain. They just go from one gyrus to another or back. And then projection goes up or down. All right, and don't forget, this is all white matter because these are axons that are myelinated. They're myelinated axons. And I think I'd mentioned one important projection. Okay. Oh, here's another really good slide. All right, so here I see myelinated axons either going up to the cerebrum or coming down. What kind of white matter is this? Is this commissural, association, or projection?
Projection.
That's projection. Here I see fibers going through the corpus callosum. Are these projection, association, or commissural?
Commissural
pathways. All right, and as a matter of fact, I'm not sure I see any association, but association would be from one gyrus to another gyrus, right? Okay. One projection pathway that's really important is between the thalamus. Let me zoom in. All right, so here's the thalamus. Here are the basal nuclei. You should probably say nuclei, even though your book says, what, ganglia, nuclei right here. Here is a bunch of white matter between the thalamus and the basal nuclei. See this white matter right here? All right, that's an important projection pathway. We call this white area right here the internal capsule. So the internal capsule is important for descending or motor fibers that are leaving the precentral gyrus, moving down into your body to control motion in your body. And you can see a bunch of fibers all converging into the internal capsule. So when we look at this pattern right here, that kind of looks like light rays leaving a light bulb or light leaving the sun or something. So that's called the corona radiata. Corona radiata are projection fibers coming from various locations on the cerebral cortex, all converging in this internal capsule right here. Okay, the cerebellum, one of the, we've got two last areas to talk about in terms of central nervous system. Cerebellum is one of them. It's important for balance. It continuously adjusts posture. All right, so even right now you're using your cerebellum to make sure you don't fall on the floor and you're taking notes and looking around at the slides and other kinds of things that we're doing in class. And it also, the cerebellum also keeps track of your body when it's in motion so that you know exactly what your body is doing all the time. So if you were to close your eyes and I were to take your hand and put it over your head, what could you tell me about your hand? Even with your eyes closed, you would know exactly where that hand is, right? So there are sensors and joints and muscles. It relays that information to the cerebellum so you have a sense of body position, and if it's working properly. If it's not working properly, the cerebellum will make some very quick adjustments so that you don't lose your balance. Like, have you ever tripped on something? And most times what happens when you trip on something? You catch yourself, right? Every once in a while, unfortunately, maybe not. But most times the cerebellum catches those mistakes and corrects for that motion so that you don't hit the floor. All right, and so can you picture where that cerebellum is? Like, for instance, here it is. It's underneath the occipital lobe. Okay. Spinal cord. Last part of the central nervous system. Let's look at the spinal cord. All right, so here is a view of the spinal cord. Let's zoom in. So where does the spinal cord begin? Right at the foramen magnum right here. That's the spinal cord. And it goes through the vertebral canal. But it doesn't go all the way down to the bottom of your vertebral column. The spinal cord stops right about here. Right? Can you see this little pointy area right here? That's about the level of L2, lumbar 2. And this pointy end right here is what we call the conus medullaris. That's the inferior border of the spinal cord. But of course, nerves have to leave the whole extent of the vertebral column. And so from L2 all the way down to the coccyx, you don't have spinal cord, but you have nerves. And these nerves remind us of a horse's tail. So it's called the cauda equina. Cauda means tail. Equina means, guess what that means? That means horse. So here is the horse's tail right here. Okay, whoops. Let's go back. All right. Now you see, in certain parts of the spinal cord, here is an enlargement. We call this the cervical enlargement. Right, and then there is a lumbar enlargement that corresponds to two areas of your skeleton. What, in terms of your skeleton, what do you have here and what do you have down over there? What's attached to your body at those two locations? You've got your arms and you've got your legs, right? You've got your appendicular skeleton. And guess what? Your appendicular skeleton needs more connections, needs more neuronal involvement than does your internal organs, right? Because there are important reflexes in these areas right here that are inside the spinal cord, right? So because of your appendicular skeleton attaches here and here, that part of the spinal cord is a little bit larger. There are more neurons in that area, okay, as opposed to in the thoracic region. Okay, so we got cauda equina, the conus medullaris, the enlargements of the spinal cord. Okay, let's look at a cross-section of spinal cord. I think this is good right here. All right, so here's a nice cross-section of spinal cord. And this is central nervous system right here. And then nerves have to leave the central nervous system and go out to the periphery. And the way that nerves can enter or leave the spinal cord are via these structures right here that are called roots. All right, so this is the anterior part of the spinal cord. What's another name for anterior? Ventral. Here's the posterior part of the spinal cord. Another name for that would be dorsal. And usually that terminology kind of wins out, ventral versus dorsal, when we talk about the spinal cord. All right. And information can either leave this root here or this root right here. And when I say root, I don't mean R-O-U-T-E, root like a root on a tree. I guess that reminded somebody of roots on a tree. This is the ventral root. This is the dorsal root. That's how information can either enter or leave the spinal cord. And then the roots come together to form a nerve, a spinal nerve. Why do we call this a spinal nerve right here? Because where is it coming from? The spinal cord, right? So that's a spinal nerve. There are some nerves that actually leave the brain, but those we don't call spinal nerves. We call those cranial nerves. And we'll look at some cranial nerves in a little bit. Okay. Now these roots right here carry information only in one direction. What are the two possible directions? that information can go. A little bit of a thinking question. What are the two directions? It can either be afferent or efferent. And which way does afferent information go? It's sensory, so it goes from the periphery into the central nervous system, right? If it's afferent. If it's efferent, which way is it going? CNS to periphery. These routes are just one-way streets. They can only be 100% efferent or 100% afferent. They're never mixed together. And the dorsal route, right, is the afferent route, or sensory. The ventral route, right here, is going to always be 100% efferent or motor. All right, and that's kind of easy to remember. Just I'll give you a couple little tricks before we go. Where is the motor cortex in your brain? Is it anterior or posterior? It's anterior. The spinal cord kind of follows that same architecture, right? The motor part is going to be the anterior, which is what? Another name for anterior is ventral, right? So this is the motor root right here. This is the efferent root. The ventral root is the motor root or efferent root. And where do you have most sensation in your brain? Is it anterior or posterior? Posterior, parietal lobe, occipital lobe, right? That's sensory or afferent, right? And so the posterior or dorsal root right here is for sensation. So signals enter the spinal cord via the dorsal root. Nerve impulses leave the spinal cord via the ventral root. That's the motor root. All right, so just think of your brain to do that in terms of the functions of the different lobes that will define what the functions of these different roots are. And then when these two roots come together to make this spinal nerve, which way are signals going? We call that mixed. A spinal nerve contains both afferent and efferent signals because you have neurons that are going in both directions there. Okay? But a root is never mixed. It's one or the other. The spinal nerve carries information both ways. All right, so where's that sign-in sheet at? Anybody got the sign-in sheet? All right, so the stuff we talked about today is not on the test. Okay? But where's that sign-in sheet at? You got it. All right. Oh, thank you.
It's an evaluation for all three of us. That's how we
do it. Oh, okay. Okay. When's my deadline?
I don't think there is a deadline.
No deadline?
There should be a deadline. I think you were invited to come to one of our SIA